I would be very surprised and very disappointed if you were not going to be at Seder next Wednesday night. And I suspect that after the first part of the Haggadah is read, and after the first two of the four cups of wine are enjoyed, and you sit down to your meal, you'll sit down to a meal which beyond the usual matzah klais and all of the familiar Passover food will feature either chicken or brisket, but will not feature what really ought to be the staple of a Seder meal, a roast leg of lamb. I tried a number of years ago to convince whoever were the powers that be for the second Seder that year that we ought to serve lamb at the second Seder. And everybody told me most people don't like lamb, it's a very precious kind of taste. And I thought to myself, you know, the thing that we like most about the rituals is when they tie us back through time to the very beginnings of our tradition. And if you look back over time, there was nothing that was more central and more basic to the Passover night, to the Seder meal, than the eating of roast lamb. The Paschal sacrifice, what is it? It was the bringing to the shrine of a lamb, the slaughtering of the lamb, that's the way they butchered meat in those days, the roasting of the lamb at the shrine, and then sitting down as a family unit to eat the roast leg of lamb, and around the eating of the lamb, one told the story of the Passover. And yet this generation, even a generation such as ours, which claims that it likes tradition, it wants to bring back tradition in its life, chicken, brisket. What kind of tradition is that? And that's the question that lies behind what I want to talk to you about this morning. Well, if you read the book of Exodus, which is, of course, the basic myth or story, history, from which we derive the Passover, the Exodus story, you'll notice something rather strange, even anachronistic. And that is that while we assume that Seder, Pesach, commemorates Yetziat Mitzrayim, the exodus of the Jews from Egypt. In point of fact, the first Passover was celebrated before the Jews had left Egypt. If you read the story, after Moses receives the mission to go down to Egypt to free, in God's name, the slaves, he goes down, he confronts Pharaoh. Pharaoh is adamant. God has to inflict Pharaoh with a number of plagues. 9 plagues take place. And then, before the 10th plague takes place, God tells Moses to tell the people, each of them, each household is to take a lamb, an unblemished lamb of a year old, and to slaughter the lamb, and to take the blood of the lamb and to paint it onto the doorposts of the house, and then to sit down and to share the roasted animal in a Passover meal, although the word actually isn't used there. And obviously, this is part of the story which explains how it is that death, when it passes over Egypt, skips over the homes of the Israelites and enters only the homes of the Egyptians, there to destroy each firstborn. Now, if you know your Bible, and I'm sure all of you do thoroughly, you know that in a number of the Psalms, there are different numberings of the plagues. Some Psalms know 7 plagues, sometimes know 9 plagues. The traditional story, of course, has to do with 10 plagues. The various enumerations of plagues are not always the same. And what we have here is very clear evidence that when the storytellers of ancient Israel talked and retold the story of the Exodus, they weren't sure how many plagues there were, and so they embellished the story with as many plagues as they thought their audience could bear. Now, why the 10th plague in the form that it is told in the book of Exodus? And that's an interesting story. We obviously don't know what was in the storyteller's mind, except one assumes this. That if you look at the other plagues, they affect everyone. Darkness over Egypt. The Nile turning to blood. Locusts descending on the land. The 10th plague is unique in that in this plague, God specifically spares the Israelites. Obviously, what the storyteller wanted to emphasize by describing dramatically the 10th plague in this way was to suggest that God has a special care for his people, for Israel, and that he showed that care in this way. There is a special kesher, a special tie between God and this people. Now, why did he choose this particular way to illustrate the point? And here the anthropologists and the archaeologists and those who study ancient things have been able to uncover from the Middle East two facts which are of interest, which suggests that the Paschal sacrifice in the spring was a holiday which antedated the emergence of the Israelites, antedated the Exodus from Egypt, that it goes back in the first instance to a spring shepherd's holiday, and most of the people in the ancient Middle East, in fact, maintained flocks. This was the lambing season in the spring. And as you know, whenever any animal, even the human being, gives birth, that's one of the most dangerous times of all. And so it's believed, and it's still practiced in some out-of-the-way rural places, that at the beginning of the lambing season, the shepherds would take an unblemished lamb from last year's crop of kids, a one-year-old lamb, and slaughter it as a propitiatory gift to the gods, in the hope that this would be enough of a gift so that all the lambs of the new season would be born hale, whole, and well. Now, what is this business of taking the blood of the lamb and washing it, painting it, if you will, on the doorposts of the home? Well, if you go through the Middle East today, away from the great urban centers, you'll still see any number of homes with colorful paint on the doorposts. It may be yellow, it may be blue, it may be orange, it may even be red. And one of the ways in which the ancients believed that you could keep the evil spirits out of the home was to paint the color which frightened the evil spirit, which kept the evil spirit out of the home. And the technical anthropologists have a word for this, apotropaic, which comes from a Greek word, which apotropine, which means to guard against. This was an act which guarded against the entrance of the evil spirits. And so what you had is two common elements, much older than the Exodus story itself, used by this storyteller who wanted to embellish the legend of the deliverance from Egypt to prove God's special care for Israel. And he told of the 10th plague in this very specific kind of way. Now, if we look at history, we learn very quickly that the central rite of the Passover, from the time of Moses down to the end of the first century, down to the year 70 of this era, was the offering of the lamb in the home or at a shrine, and ultimately only in the temple at Jerusalem. And the offering of the Paschal sacrifice was the central rite. And then the animal, having been slaughtered, would be roasted, and then it would be eaten at a communal meal, shared by everyone in the family unit. And as they sat around this meal, they would recount the story of the original redemption. Now, there are a group of people in the ancient Middle East, there are hardly more than 300 or 400 of them left, but they've lived there for a long, long time, almost 2,500 years. They're called the Samaritans. The name is taken from the city of Samaria. They were near relatives of the Israelites, of the Hebrews, who broke away from the Jewish tradition, we believe, around the 3rd or 2nd century before the Common Era, on the grounds that they claimed that Samaria, not Jerusalem, was intended to be the central sanctuary of the people. There was a temple in Samaria. That was their temple. and they perform there their rites. And they have a Torah scroll just like ours, except interestingly, they kept an archaic form of writing. Ours is newer, theirs is older in that sense. And their Torah is identical to ours, except in one respect. It changes the emphasis on a single central sanctuary in Jerusalem to the emphasis on a single central sanctuary in Samaria. Otherwise, the Torahs are identical. And these people have maintained a rather primitive form of Judaism down to modern times, and on Seder night, they go up a mountain called Gerizim, which is the hill right in back of Samaria, and on the top of the mountain, they offer there the paschal sacrifice. They have pits, and they slaughter the lamb, and then they barbecue it, they roast it, and they sit around these pits, and on Seder night, they retell the very same story that we tell of the original redemption from Egypt. Now, all of this is interesting, but if you think of that Passover and ours, you recognize how completely the paschal sacrifice has dropped out of this central focus that it once had. All that we have as a memorial of that 1,500-year period is a roasted shank bone. It sits there on the table, and at some point in the evening, we pick it up, and a child says, "My Pesach, what is this paschal sacrifice all about?" It's a very good question, because nothing's been made of it up to that point. And then we read that this is a reminder of the paschal sacrifice that was offered when our fathers left Egypt as proof of God's love for Israel. Now, this is not to say that the eating of matzah or mention of the bitter herbs had no place in the biblical Passover. They did. But it is to say that the balance has changed dramatically. And it changed because of an historical fact that it was no longer possible, once the temple was destroyed, to offer the paschal sacrifice. And so in the new formulation, which is the one that is in most of our Haggadahs, the emphasis is less on the roasted lamb bone than on the matzah. And if you ask a child in our school, any child, what is the food that's most associated with Passover, they'll say matzah. If you'd ask a child in ancient Jerusalem, they would have said the paschal sacrifice, and that's the difference. Now, what's the difference between the symbol of matzot, the symbol of the unleavened bread, and the symbol of the paschal sacrifice? When the child says, "My Pesach," what is the paschal sacrifice? We answer, it is a proof of God's special care for us. "My matzah," what is this matzah all about? This is the bread of affliction which our fathers ate in Egypt. This is the bread which they baked in haste when they went out into the wilderness. It is a sign not of God's special care, but rather of redemption in a general sense. And if you look at the Haggadah as it is written now, and you do what ought to be done with Haggadah, that is to use it as a jumping off, a springboard to a general discussion, the discussion is on deliverance, on redemption, and on freedom. Passover is perhaps the most popular of all of our holidays because it represents that which people have needed most over time, freedom. Most people in the ancient world were slaves. Most people in the medieval world were serfs. Almost all people who've ever lived have lived under some kind of arbitrary authority, a political tyranny, the oligarchy and autocracy of a family or a tribe. Freedom has been a very rare and precious commodity. And so the theme of the Passover is political and social freedom. But our ancestors recognized also that there were other kinds of freedom which were needed. People who are illiterate are imprisoned by their ignorance. People who are handicapped are imprisoned by their deficit. And so there is also the theme in Haggadah of a prayer that God will free us from those things which are not so much political as social, as deficits in terms of learning, of opportunity, of experience, of the things which so many of us have been blessed with. And it is a fact that so many of us have been blessed with so much, which leads me to the point I want to make this morning. When we sit around the Seder table and think of freedom, I wonder how many of us think in very personal terms, or rather if we're not thinking in vicarious terms. As I've read through a number of the new Haggadot, I find them speaking of the prisoners of conscience in the Soviet Union. I find them speaking of Jews who are still trapped in the Arab world. I find them speaking of Jews whose lives are uncertain in the Argentine or in the Union of South Africa. I find them speaking of the blacks and others who are imprisoned by the prejudices of their own people or of other peoples. But I find very little which speaks directly to me and my situation. And my situation as yours is a rare one. We are free people. We are free. We vote. We choose our leaders. We are free. Most of us have enough to eat. We are free of want. We are free to express our views. We are free to meet here as a religious community. We are free of ignorance. We were given the opportunity of schooling, even if we didn't all take the greatest advantage of it that we should. We are free to follow our chosen occupations and professions. In the history of the world, we are that very tiny minority, probably 1/100 of 1%, who have ever been free. Now, what does Passover mean for a free people? What does it mean for us? Freedom's a strange virtue, strange blessing. When the children of Israel left Egypt, what happened? They crossed the Red Sea and they were free. But within 3 days, they were murmuring against Moses and they were saying, "Take us back to the flesh pots of Egypt. At least there we got twice a day enough gruel to survive. Here, we've got to listen to some guy named Moses who's telling us to go to a promised land that we really don't particularly care about. Here, we don't know where we're going, what we're going to do, or how we're going to get there." What is the symbol of Haiti in our newspapers? Suddenly, a people is free. Free of a dictator, the baby doc. And they don't know how to manage their freedom. They clearly don't know how to organize a life in which they can take advantage of a rare opportunity which has been given to them. They're like the ancient Jews after they left Egypt. We live in a society which tends to downgrade all authority, all law. We live in a society where one of the emerging political parties calls itself libertarian and argues that there ought not to be any governmental restraints at all. The economy and the individual ought to be completely free. That's not a Jewish way of looking at life. Judaism believes in rules and discipline. That's what the Torah is. Torah means instruction, duty, obligation, God's law. And though Judaism recognizes quite easily that the laws of the state, whatever state, are inevitably less than perfect, inevitably they to a degree manipulate people, inevitably they take advantage of certain groups, nevertheless our tradition tells us, dini demalchus dini, the laws of the state are obligatory. Even if they're poor, poorly devised, poorly written, poorly constructed, somewhat unbalanced in their implication. Because without law, the rabbi said, people would eat each other up alive. There are only three cases in which you are commanded to disobey the law of your state. If some superior authority tells you to kill another person, if you're told impose yourself sexually on another person, or if you're told to blaspheme God. Otherwise, the tradition is, accept the idea of there is an essential virtue in an organized society. We couldn't move through our streets if they weren't organized by traffic lights, by laws. We wouldn't be free of infectious diseases if by law we didn't require a child to be inoculated for these diseases before they entered into the public schools. There are laws which protect, and there are laws which are necessary and sound and good, and even when they are not totally sound and good, Judaism prefers a lawful society to an anarchic society. And so it is that Judaism related two events. Historians now believe, interestingly, that the Exodus from Egypt may have taken place at one time and the granting or the covenant at Sinai may have taken place at another time. That it may have, different tribes may have been involved, but somehow over time, our tradition bound together these two stories. And this Erev Rav, this mixed multitude, this motley as the Bible calls them, this stiff-necked people who came out of Egypt, remained a motley, a murmuring group of people who didn't know where they were going or why or how they were going to get there. Until they come to Sinai, accept a covenant, and then there's the beginning of a sense of unity, of common purpose. It's not complete, obviously, but there's the beginning of a sense of a community, of people pulling together, of people trying to move in a single direction. And interestingly, our fathers were never satisfied with Passover as a holy day, a festival unto itself. Just as the Exodus is complemented and completed by Sinai, 3 months later, according to the Bible, so the Passover is completed by the holiday of Shavuot, which marks the giving of the law to Moses on Mount Sinai, which took place by our tradition 50 days later. And to symbolize that connection, the traditional synagogue has a ritual in which each of the days between Pesach and Shavuot are numbered off. They're called Sefirah, the numbering. There are 49 of them. And if you went into a traditional synagogue, you'd have seen on the wall a Sefirah calendar, which would be changed each day. And the object was symbolically to tie these two themes together. Freedom from, freedom for. Freedom, responsibility. Redemption, obligation. And here we are, a free people, free human beings, free individuals. Yet here we are, part of a society which is determinedly individualistic, where people get elected to public office because they proclaim the deregulation of all of our lives. That is freedom. Society where one of the conventional bits of wisdom is, I'm going to do my own thing and nobody's going to tell me how to do it. A society in which all of the basic ties of family and community have been weakened by this kind of approach. And here we have a society which I think can learn something from the way in which our tradition reshaped Passover over time. At first it spoke of God's special care for Israel. And then it spoke of the general theme of redemption, redemption of all peoples, redemption of all communities, as well as of Israel. And to us, in our new situation, I submit to you, Passover must speak not only of what others need, but of what we need. And what we need in our lives is a new sense of responsibility. Those who proclaim their freedom the most are often what my father used to call rebels without a cause. People who are porcupine people. Every quill is up. Don't touch me. Don't come near me. I'm going to hunker my own way through life. But that's not the way Judaism suggests we must live. Passover is Seder. We come together. It's not a solitary holiday. It's a family moment. It always has been. It emphasizes the ties of love, of community, of responsibility, which bind. And it's only as we admit that freedom is to be enjoyed within the context of relationships, of community, not by walking off alone, but by becoming one among and within. By learning to be free, even as we accept the bonds and the limitations of our responsibilities and our relationships. It's only in those terms that I think Passover can continue to have its most important meaning for you and for me. We no longer eat lamb Passover night. I gave up that fight. We will enjoy the matzah, because most of our world still needs the freedoms that we enjoy. But the food that we need is the food of a new kind of acceptance of responsibility. Not deregulation, but re-regulation. Regulating our lives by God's law, by duty, the divine ought, by what we know we must be. In our tradition, I close with this. In our tradition, Israel is described, all peoples are described as servants. Our tradition never says you're to be totally free. It always says, Ki avadim li, you are to be servants to me, that is to God. And the service we owe to God is a service of responsibility. Responsibility to all those with whom we have ties, and that means to all of God's creatures. Amen.